I had known Cairns for quite some time before I discovered that he was an avid sports fan. There was no television then, but he listened to the Saturday night hockey games, to the broadcasts of baseball games, or just about anything else that was possible to get on the radio. Later, of course, when the TV came in, he was one of the first to get a television so that he could watch the football games and the hockey games. When the time came to decide when to retire, he'd already made up his mind to take early retirement. He decided to leave the survey, I think, about the 1st of April, 1952. The timing was deliberate, as he wanted to see the British Empire Games in Vancouver. And he thought this would be a good way to get seriously into retirement. The highlight of those games was the second sub-4-minute mile at which John Bannister and John Landry were pitted against each other. This was the first confrontation of the two best milers in the world, and the question was, would they beat 4 minutes in Vancouver, and if so, who would win? Well, it was a great race. It was broadcast all over the country. I listened to it in my car down in eastern Canada one day. Bannister won it. Clive Cairns was extremely pleased. The games ended a day or so later. He went to the hospital for a checkup and died in the hospital. Not a bad ending. It was about this time, new paragraph here, it was about this time that the survey was reorganized along with other parts of the department, so that it once again became a branch with its own director. George Hume, who had made a name for himself in the wartime problems concerned with fuels, especially petroleum, and who had also made a name for himself as a geologist in the West, was appointed the first director, with George Hansen continuing as chief geologist. It wasn't too long before Hume was made what was called Director General of Scientific Services, succeeding W.B. Tim from the mines branch, and he moved off uptown to be in closer association with the minister. I should think that most people on the survey were rather surprised when Walter Bell was named to succeed Hume as director of the survey. Everyone liked and admired Walter Bell. He was a very fine person, an excellent paleobotanist, and a man who was dedicated to the Geological Survey. But he had steadfastly escaped administrative responsibility, except for being head of paleontology for a few years, a very small section, and didn't seem to be in the running. When Hume asked me what I, as one of the younger fellows, thought of the appointment, I said we were all pleased, but rather surprised that it should have been Walter Bell. His remark was, "Surprised? Why should you be surprised? He had the most seniority of anybody on the staff." I'm glad to say that times have changed in that respect, and as far as possible, directors are selected on the basis of their suitability for the job. This would imply that Walter Bell was not a good director. Not at all. he was a good director, and I think he and George Hanson made a good team, except that neither liked the politicking that one has to do at that kind of level in order to achieve one's goals. And perhaps we suffered slightly at that time, in respect especially to the Mines Branch, which had been vigorously supported by W.B. Tim and continued to be supported by John Conway as its director. However, there's no doubt that George Hume had a strong influence in the power circles about the Geological Survey of Canada. New paragraph, I guess. Walter Bell was a medium-sized, rather slender, spare man, vigorous, strong, and very active. His activity kept up until he died. After he retired from the survey, he was kept on for some time as special advisor and made substantial contributions to the continuing work of the organization long after other people would normally have packed it in. He was terribly absent-minded, and many of the stories concerning his activities relate to this point. For example, Frank Beals, University of Toronto, had done a couple of seasons' work in the field for the survey and was spending the following summer in Ottawa working the material up for a report. It happened that during the summer he was in Ottawa, his place of residence was fairly close to that of Walter Bell, and they used to walk together to work fairly frequently or return home together discussing matters of paleontological concern. Came the end of the summer, and Beals had done all he could do, and it was time to go back to the University of Toronto. Of course, men were flooding in from the field, and many used to go up to the director's office to say hello, and Beals thought that it would be a good idea if he went up to say goodbye. He entered the office. Bell was working at the desk, looked up, saw him coming in, said, "Well, well, Beals, glad to see you. Did you have a good summer?" Beals allowed he did, left. One of his other difficulties, that is to say Bell's, was that he had some problem in distinguishing between Harker and McLaren. I suppose because both were immigrants from England and had a somewhat similar accent, although not too much like, about the same height and same general look, I suppose. Anyway, McLaren and I were going skiing one glorious February afternoon, and as we were putting skis on top of the car, Bell passed on his way back to the survey from lunch. He commented that we had a glorious day for it, and we agreed. I went on and had a very fine day afternoon of skiing up in the Gatineau. Meanwhile, back at the survey, some renovations were underway, and Harker discovered that there were some pieces of 2x4 oak that were being ripped out and for which nobody laid any claim. He thought these were very good pieces of lumber for some project he had in mind. So he phoned his wife to bring the car at 5 o'clock, and he would load on the 2x4s on the ski rack on his car. Mrs. Harker arrived, and Harker was in the process of loading these broken pieces of 2x4 on the ski rack of the car when Bell came out, mistaking Harker for McLaren, said, "My word, you did have a difficult day." Well, anyway, all the stories that relate to Walter Bell relate to him very kindly, because I know of no one who was more highly regarded in my time on the Geological Survey than Walter Bell. New paragraph. C.H. Stockwell was, I think, one of the giants on the Geological Survey. He probably had more influence on me and my development as a scientist than did anyone else. So perhaps my enthusiasm for him ought to be discounted a bit because of self-interest. At any rate, at the age of 82, he has just turned in another large work on behalf of the Geological Survey of Canada. I first met him as a student assistant in 1938 in southeastern Manitoba, where we worked our butts off for C.H. Stockwell. He had the knack of getting the most remarkable enthusiasm in his quiet way from his students. He got us all together at one stage towards the end of the season, probably a month ago or so, pointed out how much money he had left in his field allotment, the amount of work we had to do, and then said we were going to have to work even harder to finish off our activities, complete the map sheet. There were 6 students on the party, and they worked as hard, willingly, as any group that I have ever encountered in my life. I had worked on a farm, and I never worked any harder on the farm, even during the harvesting season, than I did that last month for Stockwell. On one occasion, another assistant and I were sent away on a field trip, which was to take a certain number of days, let's say 15 days. We lost a day because of weather, so that when we started off on our 2-day return trip, we were a day behind. Knowing that the boss was short of money and was desperate to finish the map area, the other assistant and I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We were on our way before daybreak, and we paddled and portaged all day with no stop for lunch, and arrived back at the camp after dark that same day, figuring, of course, that having got back on time, we would certainly get a day off. Cliff, however, said, "My, he was glad to see us," that he was wondering what he was going to do in order to get groceries from Beresford Lake, so that now that we were back, we could do it. So the next morning, the same assistant and I started off again to make 8 portages and do a lot of paddling to get to Beresford Lake to pick up groceries. When we got there, we found that it was not Saturday, as we had thought. It was Sunday, and everything was closed up. Since we were expected back the following day, there was nothing for it but to inquire around and eventually walk a couple of miles to the place where the storekeeper was spending Sunday. He came back to the store and gave us our supplies, with one exception. We had needed, I think it was 8 cans of powdered milk. He had no powdered milk. So we took along 24 cans of carnation milk. This meant that instead of carrying about 10 pounds, we now had to carry 50 pounds. So the next morning early, back we went. Got to the camp for a late supper with our legs bowed from portaging. At supper time, Stockwell said, "Well, you fellas have been working pretty hard. We'll give you an easy day tomorrow." But all we got was a 7-mile traverse through Old Burn, which meant that we stumbled and hacked our way over deadfall on an easy day following 17 days of steady work. We finished the map area on September the 30th as scheduled. New paragraph. Cliff didn't really believe in doing any portaging or such like when there was geology to be done. So on days when we had to move camp, and we had a pretty big camp, he would maybe help us across the portage on the first trip and then would keep on going on a day's work with one of the assistants. This meant that for a camp of 7 people, that there would be 5 left to do the portaging, which is okay, I guess. I was always left to do the portaging, which may indicate something. The one occasion I remember during this 30 days in September of 1938, 2 of the lads were away on a fly camp, and of course on a fly camp you always traveled as light as you could, and he took one of the assistants on a traverse, which meant that there were 3 of us left to in effect portage the outfit of 7. The only significant difference was a bit of grub, a couple of personal packs and a canoe. They were away on the fly camp. It was a hell of a portage, as I recall, something over 3/4 of a mile, through deadfall, tough going, to a creek. When we got in a creek, there wasn't enough water to run the motors or even to float us in the canoes. Being only 3 of us with 2 canoes, we wound up dragging the canoes up the creek, sometimes going up to our waists in water, till we got to the lake. There was a lift over there, and this was just dark. We lit a flashlight to see what a message that was left in a stick stuck in a crack in the rock had to say, and it was a note from Cliff with a sketch of the lake. We had no map of the lake. Sketch of the lake saying that they would look for a campsite in this area, the area being circled. So we unloaded the canoes, dragged over the lift over, loaded up, put the canoes in tandem, and started the motor, which went. At this point, I realized that we didn't have any more gasoline than whatever happened to be in the motor. Also, it was dark. We had no map of the lake. We hadn't a clue as to where the shoals might be, but we knew approximately the direction we had to go. So away we went, I running the motor. And we were out in the middle of the lake, somewhere in the area within the circle, we realized, when the motor stopped, and as it did, there was a bang up in front of the canoe, and we'd hit a floating log. Just as well the motor had stopped, I guess, or we might have overturned. Anyway, at this instant, I saw a match flare over in somewhere to one side, so I screamed over in rage and frustration, irritation and whatever, "Have you found a decent place to camp?" And the answer came floating back across the water from our cheerful boss, "The best we've seen since dark." He, of course, had worked until he couldn't see the rocks any longer, too. Anyway, we got camp up. It wasn't much of a place, but as it turned out, it was the only one on the lake. We had supper that night, about midnight, and at 8 o'clock the next morning, at 6 o'clock the next morning, we were on our way again, doing our regular chores. I don't know how you get a guy that can make people enjoy working so hard for them. Many years later, I bumped into the assistant that with whom I had spent most of the tough times that summer. And we were having a beer, and he said in a reflective voice, "You know, I think of that summer. You know, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't." But he said it with a smile, and obviously he'd have jumped at the chance to have another session like that with Cliff Stockwell. New paragraph. Within the then Civil Service Commission regulations, there was no way that one could pay a scientist really for his scientific capacities. There was a limit in salary beyond which he couldn't go. If he wanted to become fairly well off, he had to accept a job that had substantial administrative responsibilities. Shortly after I became director, the opportunity came to appoint Cliff Stockwell as chief of the, I think, Precambrian Division. I did this with considerable reluctance, because I knew that Cliff, while he would take the work conscientiously, wouldn't like it. He would much rather be concerned with his geological studies. And as a scientific leader, he could make a significant and more important contribution. However, I had been on a committee that was looking at the rates of pay that one might assign to various people, kinds of people, and there seemed to be a possibility that we might be able to get a substantial increased level for the scientists, for their contribution as scientists, not as administrators. And in the event, we managed to get it. I'm glad that I had the chance to participate in that. And the first individual to be proposed for this senior science category, now called a research scientist 4, I think, was Cliff Stockwell. We got a lateral transfer from chief of division to the senior research category at no loss in salary to him. He was the first in the public service. It's fairly commonplace now, but at that time, it was really quite a step forward. And I'm pleased that I had a hand in it, and that Cliff Stockwell was the first beneficiary of the new attitude. Hans Freibold was the second one, I think. I know there have been many others since, Bob Boyle included, but I'm sort of out of touch with that now. Anyway, the idea that somebody by his own efforts could merit a senior level without administrative responsibilities was, in the late 50s, practically unheard of on this side of the border. I had been pushing this procedure because I knew that it had been used with considerable success in the United States Geological Survey. The other officer of the Geological Survey who had a profound influence on my professional development was Willis Ambrose. I became his assistant the year after I had worked for Cliff Stockwell, and it was a wonderful year My appetite had been whetted. Theological problems were keeping me fully occupied to get out with Willis, where we had, there's only Willis and myself on the field party, plus a cook, canoe man, whose only contribution to cooking was opening a can of sausage and boiling potatoes. Anyway, apart from that, I worked every day with Willis Ambrose, reviewing, redoing, re-examining an area that had been done the year before by his senior assistant, Willis having managed to mistake his foot for a chopping block and been laid up for practically the whole season the year before. To be able to work with a skilled geologist on a one-to-one basis for a whole summer was an experience that was very fortunate for me at that time, especially someone who was as kind and with such a sense of fun as Willis Ambrose. He wrote a great many nonsense verses, some even while we were on traverse, and I'm enclosing a group, the only ones that I have, of the verses that Willis Ambrose wrote during his period with the Geological Survey. He left to become a private consultant, later became professor at Queen's, and finally Miller Research Professor at Queen's University. And he had just retired from that when he died from a heart attack. It was good fun and a good learning experience to be with him. His wife came out to the field for a week or so, stayed at our camp, and this involved a certain amount of socializing. One day, Mr. and Mrs. A were to go to a party in Naranda, which involved crossing the lake in a canoe, taking the survey panel truck into Naranda, and then making the reverse trip. Willis was complaining bitterly about having to go to this party. He knew what would happen. It would be late getting started. It would be late the meal and so on, and they'd get in late and they'd feel terrible the next day and so on and so on. Anyway, they left in due course, and I happened to hear the motor as the canoe returned to our dock at full daylight the next morning. Looked at my watch, it was 6 o'clock, our normal getting up time. But it was a Sunday, so we stayed in for a bit. And we had a little cabin that we were using as a cook shack and office at that time. So finally, the cook, canoeman, and myself went into the cabin and cooked up some breakfast and a big pot of coffee. In due course, Willis came in for breakfast, looking like hell, hoarse voice, and I said, well, how was the party? Oh, he said, just like I told you last night. He said, and he went on and on about all the things that were poor about the party. While he had a couple of cups of coffee and didn't want anything to eat, he'd been there for nearly an hour when his wife came bouncing into the shack. And I said, well, how did you enjoy the party? And she said, oh man, what a party. And you should have seen Willis playing patty cake with Mrs. Price. And this is a continuation of Willis Ambrose. Text begins. Willis was quite skilled at writing up verse, apparently on the spur of the moment. He parodied various things, and I enclose copies of 3 of his verses that I have been able to come across. Now remember that these were written nearly 50 years ago, and the one marked number 1 was written at a time when the chief treasury officer, who was appointed by the accountant's office to liaise with the particular branch or department, would examine the accounts and write directly to the field officer. And he got the sorts of replies that were similar to those expressed in verse by Willis Ambrose. Late in the 30s, this procedure was changed, and the party chiefs used to get letters saying, signed by the chief geologist or the director, saying the chief treasury officer comments as follows, so that the guys had to write back to their own major bosses, and the replies became quite subdued, let's say. The second refers to the outfitting for the field. In those days, of course, the survey used a lot of horses, and the equipment officer was a gentleman named Sam Steves, hence the reference to him in number two. The one marked number three was written when I was a student assistant to Willis Ambrose. On this particular day, flies were bloody awful, and I was running the compass line. I was down in the swamp, and Willis had haired off to the right to look at an outcrop and seemed to be gone a terribly long time. I thought he must have found a gold vein or something. So eventually I hollered over and said, "Is everything okay?" "Oh," he said, "I'm composing." I was somewhat indignant. "Composing what?" "Oh," he says, "writing a verse." And then about 2 minutes later, he spouted the verse that is marked number three, which I thought was not bad for perhaps 15, 20 minutes while surrounded by flies on an outcrop in the lowlands near Clarissy, PQ. Now we have a new one, J.C. Sproul. Cam Sproul left the survey very close to the time that I joined it and did very well for himself by establishing the company of J.C. Sproul and Associates. Cam was noted for having a fairly substantial nose, and on one occasion, so he said, he got into quite a heated argument at some meeting or other with Professor Rutherford of the University of Alberta. And they both of them got quite heated and said some intemperate things to each other in loud voices. And the chairman brought it to a halt by saying, "Gentlemen, gentlemen, please desist. Seldom in my life have I seen two men who look so much like one end of a horse, sound so much like the other." The next one is H.V. Ellsworth. When I joined the survey in 43, Ellsworth was getting pretty well along in years, but still an interesting and challenging man to talk to. He liked to do whatever he could to get you into a corner and see if he couldn't make a fool of you. He'd started life as a chemist, and I had too. And when he discovered this, he had some sort of a fellow feeling for me, I guess, and thought that since I had been a chemist, I should be a better geologist. Be that as it may, one day, he wrapped up some specimens in photographic emulsion. Specimens that D. Forche and I had brought back from Otter Rapids on the Abitibi River in 1944, I think. Anyway, we had gone up there to look at a radioactive mineral deposit that had been discovered by Alex Mosher and another prospector named Kenty. Can't remember Kenty's first name. At any rate, that's a story in itself. We finished the one with Ellsworth. Ellsworth had wrapped these up in photographic emulsion, and he asked us to look at some photographic emulsion of a specimen from Great Bear Lake, and then at the one from Otter Rapids, and to tell him if we could see any difference. So Eve looked at him, and he said no, he couldn't see any significant difference. This is after quite a long examination. And I looked at him, and the only difference I could see, but didn't realize it was, didn't know whether it was significant or not, was the fact that the tracks in the emulsion from Otter Rapids were longer than those of Great Bear Lake. This seemed so obvious, I couldn't imagine that this is what Ellsworth was looking for, but since that was the only thing I could see, I said, yeah, the tracks in Otter Rapids are longest. So then Ellsworth went on and said, that shows your chemical training. That's exactly right. You've got to be an observer. You've got to understand, see things if you're going to understand chemical reactions, etc., etc. Eve, meantime, was getting so upset about this that he was fit to be tied. And maybe it shows that even you should say the obvious, even if it is, to your mind, so obvious it isn't worth saying. Anyhow, to get back to Otter Rapids, Eve and I went up there, and it was agreed that we would meet Alec Mosher and Kenty, Albert maybe, at the camp, which was about a mile and a half or so from the railway track over towards the river. In those days, the Ontario and ONNR, Ontario Northland Railway, would stop anywhere if there were passengers aboard, so they let us out at the head of the backpacking trail, and Eve and I loaded on quite a pile of stuff that we had with us, because this was late October, I believe. Anyway, it was in October and pretty damn cold up there. We had a stove and all that sort of nonsense. We'd gone a short distance when Eve Forche's pack slipped a bit, and instead of pulling straight back on his head, it canted him over to the side a little bit. But rather than stop and readjust, he kept slogging ahead. So that by the time we got to the camp, it was nearly dark then, Eve had a wry neck that you wouldn't believe. He couldn't straighten up for 5 days afterwards. Or he couldn't bend over, rather, for 5 days afterwards, and his neck was at it. His head was at an angle to the vertical at all times. And the result was that Kenty and I had most of the job of putting up the tent, because Alec Mosher had suffered a bleeding ulcer and had emergency surgery, and he was told that he had to take things easy. Kenty, I might say, was about 75 years old at the time. That didn't seem like that at all. So anyway, we started putting the tent up, and we had the stovepipes to put together. They came in flat sheets, and they had to be heeled together into little catches. Well, by this time, my hands were very cold, were wet with snow and one thing or another. I was having difficulty getting this damn stovepipe to fit, so I hit it with the heels of my hands coming together to try and force the damn thing to close. My hand slipped on the stovepipe and dragged my thumbs across the ragged top edge of the stovepipe. So I wound up with two deep cuts, one on each thumb. So here were three people in camp to look at this wonderful prospect, and it had lots of kicks on the Geiger. And the only person who was fit was the oldest man of the crew. That was the most decrepit-looking party I ever had anything to do with. Anyway, get back to Ellsworth. One of Ellsworth's contributions, I guess, to the arts consisted in having taken chemistry at McGill
and staying in the same boarding house as that being occupied by a young fellow named Paul Hebert, who was taking a master's degree in philosophy. And he and Ellsworth used to argue at great length about the relative merits of this, that, and the other thing. And Ellsworth, by golly, persuaded Hebert that unless Hebert took chemistry and understood the precision of chemistry, he would not be able to understand philosophy. So he, after he finished his master's in philosophy, he took his master's in chemistry. Then so Hebert told me years later, he flipped a coin to see which way it came, and he took chemistry. However, this is the same Hebert that later wrote the humorous novel called Sarah Binks, which has now been made into plays and is best known perhaps for the one-man show that Gordon Pinsent has put on called Sarah Binks, which ran for several weeks in Ottawa in the winter of 1980-81. Well, anyway, to carry on with Hebert for a bit, not much to do with Ellsworth, but I graduated first with most of my effort in chemistry. And Hebert was my professor. And I guess I was a pretty good analyst. Anyway, he got me a job. I worked for 2 years as a chemist. And went back to university to take geology. Much to his, dismay, that's too strong a word, but he was a little disappointed that a student for whom he'd got a job as a chemist would now bite the hand that fed him and go upstairs to take geology in the science building. At any rate, he came up one day, I can't remember why, I was talking to Professor Ed Leith at the University of Manitoba when Hebert came in, and this would be, I should think, in October, maybe November of 1938. A year before war with Nazi Germany broke out. And when he walked into the lab where Leith and I were talking, he was wearing a brand new worsted wool suit made in England. Leith said, "My God, Paul, it's a pretty nice thread you got there." Paul says, "Yeah, I figure there's going to be a war pretty soon. We may not be able to get any suits, so I thought I'd better get one while I could." He says, "In fact, I got two, just like this." At which point, Leith flipped the fly in the front of his trousers and said, "Good heavens, Paul, you haven't got zipper." "No," said Paul, "I don't hold with a zipper. I had a zipper on my sweater and it wore the end off my tie." Well, that's not much to do with the survey, except as a sort of a sidelight on what happens when people start serious discussion. Incidentally, it has been said often about Hebert that he would teach you just enough chemistry so that you could pass the exam. The rest of the time he would spend teaching philosophy. If you wanted a good mark in chemistry, you had to work at it yourself. And that's true. Now, I guess I better say a few words about Yves Fortier. Yves and I joined the survey within a week of the same date, and we were assigned on twice on joint field projects. So I got to know Yves pretty well in his younger days, and I've stayed good friends with him ever since. We worked together first, I think it was in the fall of 43, we were looking for quartz crystals up in the area north of Gananoque. And we stayed at a farmhouse at a place called Black Rapids, where we had a couple of bedrooms and the dining room as our work area. We'd work all day, and this was in October, November, and it was pretty darn cold. And then we'd come back to the farmhouse about dark, where we'd get something to eat, maybe after a drink,
And Eve had apparently never had hot buttered rum. So I got a bottle of overproof rum. You could get it in Ontario in those days. And made up some hot buttered rum one evening. And Eve sipped his, sipped it again. His eyes rolled up, and he says, "My, that slips down like a pair of velvet panties." So from which I take it that he liked hot buttered rum. Eve was a terrifically hard worker and was well able, one of the best I've ever come across at conceiving, putting things together. His weakness, I think, was in wanting one more bit of supporting evidence before he published. However, be that as it may, he could think things out just about as well as anybody I know. And his work on Operation Franklin, I think, shows that. That was truly a monumental piece of work. He organized that right from day one through to the compilation and final edition of the report. And he deserves a medal for it. I hope he gets it. Whenever females were around, he used to sparkle like champagne. It was really quite amazing to see how he lit up when there was a young woman nearby. And when he met his wife, he was on a skiing holiday towards the end of March. He came back absolutely ecstatic about this young woman, very talented, very beautiful, that he'd met skiing. In fact, he was walking 4 feet off the ground. It was one miserable rainy day in early April when we were leaving the museum, and one of the sourest commissionaires it's ever been my experience to have anything to do with was on the job that evening as we were going out to dinner. And Eve was prancing down the hall around the rotunda in the museum, and this sour-faced commissionaire, probably just having come in from outside soaking wet in the icy rain and wind, saw this crazy nut waltzing around as if it really was spring. He got a very sour look on his face, and Eve went up to him and put his hands on his shoulder and says, "What's the matter with you? It's a beautiful day today." Waltzed out into the rain. I'm sure that the commissionaire thought that he had a nut on his hands. Well, he did too, but Eve and Trudy actually got married, I think, less than 2 months after they first met, which is pretty good going. And they've had a good life together. Very fortunate, very nice people, both of them. Now G.A. Young. Young was the chief geologist at the time that I applied for the survey, but by the time I got to the survey in middle of May 1943, he had retired a couple of weeks before. I did meet him two or three times, and I certainly heard a lot about him. He was one of the old school. He believed that you could do things the hard way and get away with it. He read every paper and report that was ever written by a geologist on the survey during his tenure as chief geologist. In fact, he went farther. I've heard several people comment, rather bitterly some of them, that they would leave G.A. Young their paper, report, whatever, when they went to the field, come back to find that he had rewritten it and sent it in for publication. In some cases, at least,
the way he had modified the paper did not suit the presumed author. But of course, his authority was absolute, and it would be quite impossible to write to the editor of whatever journal it had been sent to, or, if it were published as a geological survey report, there was nothing that anyone could do to try and countermand this thing. Absolutely autocratic. When I asked him some questions about life on the geological survey, he gave me the most equivocal answers that I've ever gotten from anybody in such a position. On the one hand, but on the other. You couldn't get anything out of him at all. I remember hearing once, I think it was Willis Ambrose, had said he put in a request for a vehicle, motor car, for the summer. He said that Young got him up to the office and gave him quite a dressing down for asking for a car. He said, well, we didn't have cars in my days, and we got our work done, and so on and so on. So Willis said, well, if you want to pay $150 a day for a field party to walk around on perfectly good roads, that's all right with me. He got his car. But that, he wouldn't allow aircraft. When I came on the survey, although many other agencies were using aircraft as a fairly general thing, it wasn't until about 1947 or 48 that aircraft got generally to be used for field work in the north. By this I mean you got carried up to the field area and you got your supplies brought in by an airplane, but the idea of using airplane to save people from portaging, wasting days portaging from one river system to another, that sort of thing, just wasn't on. You were expected to do it yourself. And I think maybe in 1947 I was one of the first that really had an aircraft on call for my party and one or two others jointly. I don't think we had it full time. In 1948 we certainly had one aircraft full time for all the field parties working in Manitoba. And that was certainly one of the earliest, largely because of G.A. Young's influence that you did things the hard way. He was the son-in-law of A.P. Lowe, and he admired the old man tremendously in his fortitude. And I think it was partly that that controlled his thought processes. At any rate, it seems like damn near everybody was frightened silly of him. W.H. Collins, I didn't know. He died quite a while before I came to the survey. But I think that nearly everyone knows the story of his daughter, eldest daughter, eloping with A.C. Lawson at a time when Lawson was in his 80s, and she was in her about 20. They were married, and later on, when Lawson was about 90, she conceived and had a son. Presumably one of the very first of the babies conceived with sperm from an unknown donor. At any rate, here was Andy Lawson, 93 years old or something like that, with a new son. Now, Dunk Whitmore, who later worked for the survey, married the youngest daughter of W.H. Collins. So Whitmore was able to say that he was the uncle of Andy Lawson's child. And of course Andy Lawson was then his brother-in-law. This caused a few people to gulp in some astonishment when they heard this. 1947, I think it was, the Geological Society of America met in Ottawa, and E. Forche had the notion of getting all the over 80 people together in one row in the museum auditorium for some special function of the GSA, which he did. And that was one of the most imposing arrays of geological names of that day that it would be possible to find anywhere. It was A.C. Lawson, there was A.C. Lane, J.C. Hobbs, Bailey Willis, and I forget, half a dozen others. And several pictures appeared of these people. And later in the meeting, a reporter from one of the Montreal newspapers came up to A.C. Lane and A.C. Lawson, who happened to be looking at an exhibit in Peacock Alley in the Chateau Laurier. And she said to these two chaps, asking them about their lives and so forth, and they were, Lawson was never one to talk very much, and so Lane was doing most of the talking. And then she said, well, I would like to get a picture of you two people in some great discussion where you're disagreeing with each other, arguing with each other. And A.C. Lane says, look, he says, we're so old now, we don't disagree about anything much. All our enemies are dead or forgotten. And then he turned to Lawson and said, Andy, you know, there's one thing, though. You are all wrong about the Kuchiching. Andy's jaw stuck out and his beard started to quiver and the cigarette in his mouth pointed out like a pistol. And the girl, realizing that she'd got her picture, snapped it. And it looked great. And she thanked them. And when the flash gun went off, Andy Lawson sort of smirked and realized that he'd been had. Anyway, they went past me with A.C. Lane had his arm around Lawson, and as they went past me, he said, you know, Andy, you were all wrong about the Kuchiching. I think that must have been the end of a beautiful friendship. Well, one other story I think about Lawson. He only worked for the survey for a couple of summers, and he worked in the Rainy Lake area, and that is the area where he determined, to his satisfaction, that there was a older Kiewaitan assemblage and a younger Kuchiching assemblage which overlay the Kiewaitan. There's been much argument about this over the years, and I suppose someday we'll get the answer, but this was a very heated kind of exchange. And Bailey Willis and Andy Lawson came to odds over this, and they had little to do with each other from then on. This goes back to the very early 1900s. It is said that one day, when Bailey Willis was on the trip to Africa, that an erroneous report came out that Bailey Willis had been killed in an accident in the Rift Valley in East Africa. And one of the grad students rushed into Lawson's office, where he was busy looking down the barrel of a microscope. And he said, Dr. Lawson, we just got word. Bailey Willis is dead. He said, Lawson didn't raise his head from his telescope. He said, Bailey Willis has been dead for 20 years. Well, there are many more stories, I suppose, that could be told. I think I've run pretty well dry. And I think that maybe I shall drop it here and leave it to somebody more knowledgeable than I to fill this out. I would suggest that as soon as possible you get a hold of A.W. Jolliffe in Kingston and see if you can get him to tape record some of his memories of the days of the Geological Survey. He left the survey just about shortly after I arrived here. And so his corporate memory goes back a lot farther than mine does.